Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel. Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel.
From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 22nd of April, these are our main stories. Fighting in Sudan is continuing despite the announcement of a three-day truce by the army and the paramilitary group RSF. A British politician, Dominic Raab, criticises civil servants after resigning as Deputy Prime Minister over bullying claims. Peru's former president, Alejandro Toledo, is to be extradited from the US to face corruption charges. Also in this podcast,
everyone that previously was given a blue mark by Twitter because they deemed their account notable no longer has it unless they're willing to pay for it $8 a month.
The latest big shake-up at Twitter and what it means for the future of the social media platform. We start in Sudan, where there's been an escalation in fighting despite calls for a ceasefire to mark the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. Gunfire and explosions have again been heard across the capital, Khartoum. At least 400 people have been killed in a week of fighting between the army and its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The BBC's Mohamed Osman is in Khartoum, one of only a few journalists reporting from a city where 5 million inhabitants are living in fear.
Battles have been going for a week in Khartoum. Insecurity is increasing, but some still went to pray. They could hear fighting from across the city.
We were afraid, but there is nothing we can do about it. We're used to praying here every Eid. The streets were empty, which frightened us, but we hope that next Eid, things will be better.
It's a sad Eid. We hope that God raises this hardship and protects everyone. Sudan doesn't deserve this. Sudan doesn't deserve this. These people fighting should see how the situation in the country turned out to be and how people are handling it.
From this conflict, a humanitarian crisis, hundreds dead, thousands injured, most hospitals shut. The army's leader still hopes for victory.
The destruction and sounds of bullets have left no room for happiness, which our people all over our beloved country deserve. We're truly saddened by how events have unfolded, but hope remains that we will overcome this ordeal.
The streets here are empty. It is hard for people to get food and clean water. Some are making the dangerous journey out of the capital, despite the risk.
We were born here, but the fight is near us, and we can't sleep because of fear. We left our homes, my children, and I went towards the city of Mashimadi.
People left here don't have the luxury of time. They're hoping their prayers will be answered, and soon.
That report by Mohammed Osman in Khartoum. Well, the European Union has said it's planning for a possible evacuation of its citizens from the Sudanese capital. It's thought there are around 1,500 EU nationals trapped in Khartoum. The United States is also working out how to rescue its nationals from the city, given that the fighting has closed the airport. Vedant Patel is a US State Department spokesman.
Due to the unfortunate and uncertain and very fluid security situation in Khartoum, and again because of the closure of the airport, it's not safe to undertake a U.S. government coordinated evacuation of private American citizens at this time.
U.S. and British troops are being moved close to Sudan amid growing speculation they could eventually be involved in a rescue operation. Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
The Pentagon has not confirmed publicly where additional US troops are being sent in preparation for a possible emergency evacuation from Sudan, but it's been widely reported they were deployed from the sizable US military base at Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti. The US currently leases the former French Foreign Legion base on the Horn of Africa from the Djibouti government. It hosts an undisclosed number of US Special Forces operatives, as well as an emergency response team. In 2013, the Pentagon's East Africa Response Force, the IRF, deployed from there to Juba in South Sudan to evacuate more than 700 people from the US embassy. The US is now studying contingency plans for its embassy in Khartoum, but any evacuation would be fraught with difficulties. Khartoum Airport has been closed due to the ongoing fighting, and there is debris on the runway. The current State Department advice to its citizens in Sudan is to stay indoors and to, as they put it, shelter in place until the situation stabilizes.
Frank Gardner. The US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has said more tanks will arrive in Germany in the next few weeks to help train Ukrainian forces. Speaking at the end of a meeting of Western allies in Germany focused on providing more military support for Kyiv, Mr. Austin said the M1 Abrams tanks would help Ukrainian troops make further gains and reiterated that the US was in this for the long haul.
The United States and the members of this contact group remain committed to supporting Ukraine as it fights for freedom against Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion. To date, the United States has committed more than $35 billion in military assistance. Since the early phases of this war, and for every month since, the United States has provided Ukraine with the capabilities to defend itself. And in conjunction with our allies and partners, we have delivered.
The top US general, Mark Milley, also expressed confidence that the tanks would make a difference, but cautioned there was no silver bullet in war. Our correspondent in Germany, Jenny Hill, told us more about what came out of the talks.
I think, as we expected, another message of solidarity for Ukraine. These meetings of Ukraine's international allies happen regularly every few months at the Ramstein Air Base here in Germany, and they really perform a dual purpose. First of all, to coordinate the delivery of supplies, weapons and so on to Ukraine. And secondly, I suppose you could say, to reassure Kyiv of ongoing support, but also to send a message to Moscow of, if you like, defiance that the international community, such as it is rallying behind Ukraine and isn't planning to go anywhere anytime soon. And we heard a lot more about that today from the US Defense Secretary. The US was hosting this meeting, saying that Ukraine had been both capable and courageous, and that its allies, including the US, would stand behind it. It would have its back for as long as it takes, were his words. What we didn't hear today was any kind of response to President Zelensky of Ukraine's impassioned pleas, and they've really been intensifying in recent days, for fighter jets. Ukraine says it really needs modern fighter jets, F-16s. And we know that that is an issue which rather splits some of its allies. Countries like Germany and the US have been very reluctant to provide them. The thinking goes they worry about escalating the conflict. They worry about Ukraine perhaps using those jets to target Russia itself, even though Ukraine has said it wouldn't do that. So I think President Zelensky may not have been surprised, but he perhaps will have been disappointed.
And the US is also talking about sending more tanks. They'll arrive in Germany in the coming weeks, but it won't be fast enough for the Ukrainians.
Yes, the US is sending Abrams tanks, training tanks into Germany so that Ukrainians can start training on them. At the same time, Germany is going to begin training with Leopard tanks, training Ukrainians, we believe tomorrow is what the defence minister here said. The Ukrainians, of course, say we need all this, you know, faster than you can give it to us. And we know that some of the decision making has, from the Ukrainian perspective, been painfully slow. It took a long time for Germany and the US to agree to send battle tanks. They were very reluctant to do that for some time. And so this will be perhaps viewed with a degree of frustration in Ukraine. It's all very well, of course, they will say, getting these messages of solidarity from their allies, but they're not getting exactly what they want.
Jenny Hill in Germany. The British politician Dominic Raab, who's resigned as Deputy Prime Minister, has accused some civil servants of trying to block government reforms like Brexit. As we heard in the earlier podcast, Mr. Raab stepped down shortly before the publication of a report that upheld two bullying complaints against him. It found he was intimidating and aggressive towards officials. But Mr. Raab told the BBC that he thought he hadn't behaved in such a manner and that the threshold for what constitutes bullying had been set too low.
I resigned from Cabinet today because I said I would if there was any adverse finding from this inquiry, and I'm true to my word, politicians should be. But I do think it sets a very dangerous precedent. If you look at the Tolley report, it dismissed almost all of the claims against me. If the bar, the threshold for bullying is lowered that low, it's almost impossible for ministers to deliver for the British people. And I think it will have a chilling effect on effective government, and the British people will pay the price.
His decision to stand down spared the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak from the difficult task of deciding the fate of a close ally. In his 6 months in office, Mr. Sunak has now lost three cabinet ministers over scandals. The opposition has called the Prime Minister weak for failing to sack Mr. Raab and allowing him to publish his version of events before the official report was released. Our political correspondent Rob Watson told us more about what it said.
I guess you'd sum up the report, Janat, by saying that it describes Dominic Raab as essentially a rather difficult and aggressive boss to work for, and that at times that just sort of crossed the threshold of what would be considered in a modern office environment. Why did his retort, if you like, come out before the report? I suspect that was just smart politics, if you call it that, by Mr. Raab, who wanted to get his version of events out before everyone had a chance to read it.
And it's striking, isn't it, how even after the publication of this report, there's still disagreement over whether Mr. Raab was a bully or not.
Yes, and I think that's partly the nature of the report. I mean, it doesn't find Mr. Raab guilty on every single charge brought against him by civil servants. But I think actually that division is more the result of the division in our society, the sort of post-Brexit culture wars, if you could put it that way. So those who support Mr. Raab, who think that Britain has become a place that's too politically correct, too woke, where politicians can't tell civil servants what to do, are on one side and think the report was unfair, whereas those on the other side think, hang on a minute, this is just clearly unacceptable behaviour by someone who really should not have been in high office.
And how big a blow is this for the British Prime Minister, who on his first day in the job promised to govern with integrity and appointed Mr. Raab, apparently knowing there were these allegations against him?
I think I'd put it this way, that it's just not great if you're Rishi Sunak, particularly because his whole sort of selling point is to say, look, I'm the man of trying to take drama out of British politics after Brexit and Truss and Johnson, so this doesn't look good. And there are, of course, all these questions about why on earth he appointed Dominic Raab in the first place, given these rumours about the kind of politician and kind of person he was. But I think you have to get it into perspective. I mean, one imagines that the voters in this country are probably far more concerned about the cost of living crisis, the prices going up, and the sort of strain on public services. Not that that, of course, is good for Mr. Sunak either.
Rob Watson. Britain's largest business lobby group, the CBI, has announced it's suspending key activities until June after dozens of companies left it following allegations of rape and sexual assault at the organisation. BMW, AstraZeneca and MasterCard are among the high-profile firms to sever or pause their ties with the CBI. The crisis has raised serious questions about the future of the business lobby group, as Mark Ashdown reports.
The CBI board said it shared the shock and revulsion of its members at the events that are alleged to have taken place. It said it was deeply sorry and expressed profound regret to the women involved. Around 40 businesses have so far said they will suspend or terminate their involvement with the organisation after two women said they were raped by male colleagues while working for the CBI. The police are investigating those allegations, and independent lawyers have been looking into a series of separate claims of sexual harassment, bullying and drug taking, which date back to 2015. The board said it had heard loud and clear a demand for far-reaching change. It said it would put forward proposals at an extraordinary general meeting in June for a repurposed CBI to rebuild trust and continue to represent business at what it called a critical time for the country.
Mark Ashton. Survivors of this year's devastating earthquake in Syria have told the BBC they feel forgotten and still haven't received the aid they need. More than 7,000 people died in February when it hit the country's rebel-held northwest, which is already suffering from the effects of 12 years of war. The quake also caused tens of thousands of deaths in neighbouring Turkey. Our Middle East correspondent Anna Foster reports from the Syrian province of Idlib.
Under a blue Idlib sky, a new headstone is being secured in the ground. Ali Sheikh Hazam Khanan looks on. For him, this cemetery holds a new significance. On the 6th of February, more than 60 of his relatives were killed in the earthquake. Now, they lie here.
16 buildings collapsed on the residents, and people and children went missing under the rubble.
This is a really peaceful and tranquil spot, a burial ground on the side of a hill. You can probably hear the birds in the ancient olive trees that surround this place, and you can see down the valley to the hills that mark the border between Syria and Turkey. And all around here are freshly dug graves. 61 members of the family are buried here, and they're all marked out with white breeze blocks. You can see where they've planted flowers to try and bring some colour to this brown earth that marks really the scale, the huge, huge size of this tragedy.
We were already living in suffering from the war and everything the criminal Bashar al-Assad and his helpers have done to us. Bombing and displacement and siege. Then this earthquake came and increased our suffering.
Hazem and his family have endured so much. Rebel-held northwest Syria already bore the scars of 12 years of fierce conflict. Most of the 4 million people who live in Idlib fled here to escape the fighting in other parts of the country. The devastation of the earthquake brought even more anguish. More than 10,500 buildings across northwest Syria were fully or partially destroyed by the earthquake. 300 people died in this one alone when it collapsed. Work has started to clear the rubble away, but there just aren't enough diggers here, so it's a slow process. Without enough building materials, reconstruction is still a faraway dream. An earthquake in a war zone makes families like Solomon so vulnerable. Their home was already half destroyed by an airstrike. The upper floors have been scythed away from the rest of the building. Walls and floors are missing, and doors open onto nothingness, just a long drop to the ground below.
Since the war started, we have not had one good day. And then the earthquake happened, and it made us more scared. When the aircraft used to bomb us, we used to pray to God. But now, this has come from God.
When the earthquake hits, Solomon, her children and grandchildren were terrified, knowing that their damaged house didn't provide the protection they needed. More chunks of masonry crumbled away as the family ran outside. They were lucky to survive. For them, like so many people here, there's no sign that things will get any better. Aid was slow to arrive, and many families told me they still don't have what they need, even now. It's a stark reminder of how difficult life in this isolated corner of Syria really is.
That report by Anna Foster in the Syrian province of Idlib. Still to come, a chocolate Easter egg that's more than 80 years old.
When Sybil Cook from Neath was given the chocolate egg in 1939, her uncle advised her to ration it and savour every morsel.
But after lying untouched for years, it could now be sold for hundreds of dollars.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Since fleeing his country several years ago, the former Peruvian president, Alejandro Toledo, has been living in the United States. Now, after his lawyers failed to achieve an emergency stay to block his extradition, he's turned himself in to US officials. He's wanted in Peru on corruption charges, and it seems that he'll be back there within days. Our America's regional editor, Mimi Swaby, told us more about what Mr. Toledo stands accused of.
These corruption and money laundering scandals all center around him supposedly receiving $25 million from the Brazilian construction company Odebrecht in exchange for help in obtaining public work contracts. Obviously, Mr. Toledo has denied soliciting or receiving bribes, and he has not been criminally charged in the US. That is important to note. The former president of Peru from 2001 to 2006 has lived in the States for several years, but he was formally arrested by the US in July 2019 after a request from Peru for his extradition. He was then later on bail, but now these charges have caught up with him once again.
And he's expected to be in Peru within days.
Yes, he will hopefully get to Peru in about 2 or 3 days. His lawyers have said that he has handed himself in. He's going to have a health check, mental health check, to make sure he is sound and able to travel, but that his arrival in Lima, the capital Lima, is imminent.
And this is a battle that he has fought long and hard for several years now.
Yes, it has been ongoing. The first request by Peru for his extradition was back in July 2019. So it has been a number of years, and he's been in California basically living life pretty normally, actually, and for quite a number of those years. He hasn't felt many of the consequences so far of this quite hefty accusation. Like, again, like I said, $25 billion is a huge sum.
Mimi Swaby. The United Nations has warned that saving the world's glaciers is, in effect, a lost cause. The World Meteorological Organization found that they melted at an alarming speed last year. Molly Perella has the details.
The WMO's annual climate report makes for a depressing read. It says the loss of glaciers in Europe last year was off the chart. Antarctic sea ice fell to its lowest extent on record, and the last 8 years were the hottest ever. These factors all contributed to sea levels rising twice as fast as they did 2 decades ago. The head of the WMO warned that we have already lost the battle to save glaciers and said they would eventually disappear unless something is done to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The report said the effects of climate change were obvious, from extensive flooding in Pakistan to extreme heat waves across Europe and China and catastrophic drought in Somalia.
Molly Perella. More than 50 years after Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics were killed by Palestinian militants, the German government has appointed a commission to look again at security failures. 8 gunmen from the Palestinian militant group Black September stormed into the Israeli team's apartment at the Olympic Village, shooting dead 2 of the Israelis and taking 9 of them hostage. 24 hours later, all the hostages were dead after West German police botched the rescue operation. 5 of the hostage takers and a police officer also died. Here's a sequence of events in news reports at the time, beginning with a news conference about the original attack.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim McKay speaking to you live just outside the Olympic Village in Munich, West Germany. The peace of what have been called the Serene Olympics was shattered just before dawn this morning, about 5 o'clock, when Arab terrorists, armed with submachine guns, faces blackened, climbed the fence, went to the headquarters of the Israeli team and immediately killed one man, two shots in the head, and the latest report is that one more has been killed.
Israeli Olympic racewalker Shaul Ladany was among the Israeli athletes who survived the attack at the Olympic Village.
With five others, we were sleeping in apartment number two. I opened the door and looked outside and saw one of the terrorists when he was kind of negotiating or speaking with four guards, and then returned back to the apartment. I decided not to leave the building, but I decided to warn the head of the mission, and only when I warned him, we left together the apartment.
To try to free the nine Israelis taken hostage, the German authorities, after a day of negotiations, provided helicopters to take the Arabs and their captives to an airfield where the militants were told a plane would fly them to an Arab country. The plan was to ambush them as they walked to the plane, but it failed.
Two of the guerrillas climbed from the first helicopter and walked over to inspect the jet. And as they walked back, the firing started.
The gun battle that followed led to the deaths of all nine hostages and five of the kidnappers. Shaul and the surviving members of the Israeli team returned home with the bodies of their dead teammates the next day to a country in mourning.
In 2005, the director, Steven Spielberg, made a film about what happened at Munich and the subsequent attempt by Israel to track down the killers.
We have 11 Palestinian names. Each had a hand in planning Munich. You're going to kill them, one by one.
He gets in the bed, his weight arms the device.
I give the signal by switching off the light.
Last year, the German authorities agreed to pay nearly $30 million to the relatives of those who died in Munich in 1972. So what purpose might this new commission that's looking again at security failings serve? Julian Marshall spoke to Professor Andreas Wersching, director of the Institute for German Contemporary History in Munich.
Certainly, there are a lot of unanswered questions, I would say. Of course, the exact reconstruction of the events of September the 5th, 1972, has been done, but there are still quite a lot of files unseen. They are classified, which need to be consulted. And of course, the exact history of this day doesn't need to be rewritten. That is clear. But the immediate post-history, the immediate prehistory is not so clear.
What about the immediate prehistory to those events in September 1972 and the relations between the German and Israeli government and the preparations for security arrangements for the Olympics?
Yeah, first of all, we need to have a look at the plans, the concrete planning of Bavarian and German authorities. And, of course, the exchange of secret services, for example, between Germany and Israel, but also other American and West European services. This is something which hasn't been studied yet extensively, especially because of the non-accessibility of the sources. And the question also is, concerns the mindset of German authorities. I mean, as you know, the Munich Olympic Games were seen as happy game, as a big event for the world, a German showcase, so to speak. And the mindset was certainly not prepared to have such a terrible event.
But on the day itself, were the Israeli athletes sufficiently protected?
Yeah, certainly not. We need to establish once again the history of the preparations in order to protect them. There is an Israeli-German dialogue on that. But especially what happened in Fürstenfeldbruck, where the Israeli athletes were brought by force, is rather well known. And they were certainly not sufficiently protected. And this has something to do with the unpreparedness of the German police, the Bavarian police in particular, who didn't have any experience in dealing with terrorists.
That was Professor Andreas Wersching speaking to Julian Marshall. Is it the dawn of a new era for Twitter or a signal that its time could soon be up? Elon Musk's long-promised move to remove free blue ticks from users, a signal that accounts are genuine, has begun, dividing those who've paid the monthly fee of $8 from those who have not. But mysteriously, while some high-profile users have lost theirs, for instance Donald Trump, others have kept theirs, like his daughter Ivanka. Another change is the removal of labels showing which news sites are government-controlled. And to add to the confusion, Elon Musk has revealed that he's paid the fees for high-profile users like the author Stephen King and the basketball player LeBron James, who said that they wouldn't. Alistair Keane, our tech reporter, told us more.
This is a moment that we, as the technology reporting team, have been waiting for a while, since Elon Musk took over Twitter about 6 months ago. He has spoken about changing the way these blue check marks of verification are handed out. He's had a go at changing the system before. It hasn't quite worked out. And now, I suppose finally, as he would see it, he's managed to take away all those legacy blue marks. Everyone that previously was given a blue mark by Twitter because they deemed their account notable no longer has it, unless they're willing to pay for it $8 a month. And for that, they get some extra features as well. They can edit their tweets and they can also post longer video.
But some might say this is a bit of a mess because while some people have lost their blue ticks, others have kept them. Say, for instance, in the Trump family, there are differences there. And it's emerged that Elon Musk is actually paying for a few people to keep their blue ticks because they won't pay for them.
Yeah, one of them being LeBron James, the basketball player. He had previously said publicly on Twitter that he wasn't willing to pay, and Elon Musk has decided to, well, pay for it himself. That kind of seems like a classic Elon Musk move. He likes to be a little bit different and perhaps even, some would say, controversial and do things like that just to perhaps poke a bit of a reaction. But it is getting a little bit confusing on Twitter now, because say you have multiple accounts all under the same name and none of them are verified, if you're just having a very quick glance at the platform, it's hard to work out exactly which of those is the real official account. That could be from a celebrity, but it could be from an emergency service or a government department. And if you're trying to find out information in quite a serious situation, it's going to take you a bit longer to find out what's true.
Exactly, because this will make it so much easier for people to set up fake accounts. What does this all mean for the future of Twitter?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch on the platform how long everyone's willing to stay on it. NPR, Public Radio in America, is one of those that over the past week have said they're no longer going to stay on it because they're not happy with the different changes that have been happening. Some of the celebrities that have perhaps lost their marks and are worried about impersonation will perhaps pull out of it. But others would perhaps keep logging on because they're enjoying what some would say the chaos of what's going on. Elon Musk speaks about users being at a bit of an all-time high on the platform as people log on to see what's happening. So we will keep following it very closely for the next weeks and months and see where the platform ends up.
Alistair Keane, a chocolate Easter egg which survived the Second World War uneaten is being auctioned next month. It was given to a 9-year-old girl in South Wales in 1939. But with war looming, she stashed it away, leaving it untouched until she died in 2021. The auctioneers say it could sell for more than $900. Claire Woodling reports.
When Sybil Cook from Neath was given the chocolate egg in 1939, her uncle advised her to ration it and savour every morsel. The egg survived World War II unbroken, and so Ms. Cook then decided it didn't feel right to eat it. Her daughter Jill Bolter says she loved chocolate, but she was so disciplined and respectful to her elders that she never ate a single piece. The Mary Mary Quite Contrary egg is still wrapped in its blue and white paper. The egg is expected to fetch £600 to £800 when it is sold. The auctioneers, Hansons, said that although its best before date was long since past, its nostalgia value lived on.
Claire Woodling reporting on what might be the world's oldest and possibly most expensive chocolate Easter egg. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.